QSO Today, episode 493, Jonathan Kramer, W6JLK. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. I want to thank John Grussell, KC9OJV, who became a monthly listener sponsor. We have donors who wish to remain anonymous, and we thank them for their generous support of the QSO Today project. QSO Today is commercial-free and has no paid sponsors. If you think that the QSO Today project is important to you, please become a listener sponsor or make a donation today. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio? Do people still do that?" This podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. My English-speaking amateur radio friends in Israel have asked me to invite you to speak with us on DMR and All-Star. Click on the banner in this week's show notes page or on the Talk Group menu item at the top of our QSOtoday.com webpage for more information. Dr. Jonathan Kramer, W6JLK, transitioned into becoming a communications law attorney after a successful career in cable television engineering, in addition to his amateur radio activities. Kramer stressed that amateurs should be very active in local government as a way to advocate for antenna and tower rights, especially in areas of strong HOA controls. W6JLK and I discuss the first Motorola simulcast radio system in Kern County, California, years ago, and his use of Arden and portable radios for integrating ham radio into public service. W6JLK, this is Eric 4Z1UG. Are you there, Jonathan?
This is W6JLK. Yes, I am here, Eric.
Jonathan, thanks for joining me at the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Not surprisingly, I came out of junior high school with an interest in CB radio. And in fact, we had a family CB license that caught my interest in two-way. And when I went to Hamilton High School here in Los Angeles, where I'm based, I immediately joined the radio club there, K6CXI, headed by the wonderful Jack Brown. It was there in, gosh, I've got to check my notes here because I got some notes on the dates. November 20th, 1970, that I earned my novice ticket. I was tested by someone I think you know, Mark Abrams, WA6DPB. And he was my very first contact. So that was the beginning of my ham story. I went from there. Oh, about a year and a half later, I earned my general license. About the same time, 1971, I joined the ARRL, and within about a year, I upgraded to a life member, one of the best investments I ever made.
If you know anything about the ARRL, I think, what is it, the membership, even in those days, was maybe, what, $35 a year or something like that?
That's right, but life membership was about $180.
And now it's over $1,000, I think.
Like I said, it was one of the best things I ever did. In fact, my father paid for that.
You've used $180 worth of paper in all those years.
Well, not only was it a good deal, but being there and supporting amateur radio through the league has been one of the things I've been very proud of as well. And I've had a number of contacts with the league. Currently, I'm a volunteer examiner. I'm also a volunteer counsel in the Southwest Division. I hope to get him back a bit as well.
Just a note about Mark Abrams, WA6DPB. I actually met Mark in 1974 because he was very good friends with Martin Ronnie, WB6YMI, and Skip Hansen, WB6YMH. I'm assuming that we probably all know the same guys.
We do.
And I remember at the time that Mark was building a remote base station using TTL and relay logic. on green perf board. I still see it burned in the front of my brain. But he was one of the guys that interested me in remote base stations and all the remote control stuff that was going on in those days. And so that's very interesting that our Venn diagrams cross in that way. But let me just go back a little bit. It seems to me that if your family was interested in Citizens Band Radio, and then you kind of jumped to novice in 1970, did you have an interest, an earlier interest in electronics and communications even before you got the amateur radio license?
My graduation project from elementary school, here in the sixth grade at the time, was that I built a crystal radio, and I gave a lecture to my entire sixth grade class on the history of radio, not the commercial side, but the actual broadcasting side. So yes, my interest in radio went back many years before I became a CB radio operator and then later a ham radio operator.
And did your crystal radio have a germanium diode, or did it have a cat's whisker?
No, I had a 1¾ diode. And because the school that I went to, Clover Avenue, was actually very close to KDAY-AM, that was the only station I could pick up because everything else was overwhelmed by that one strong signal. But it was a crystal radio. It worked, and it was a great project. And it just, I cannot tell you why, but for all of my life, I have been intrigued, enlightened, enraptured by radio, by two-way radio, by one-way radio, by the electronics of radio.
I get that 100%. I'm sure that all of the listeners also get that as well. Okay, so what happened after that? You got your amateur radio license. You're a life member of the ARRL. Did you continue with radio clubs and stuff like that in high school?
Well, in high school, I was really involved in the K6CXI club. That was the Hamilton High School Radio Club. And that's where really I spent the majority of my time. But my next contact between amateur radio and education came for college. And I will tell you that I was a straight C student in high school. And I mean straight C. Because it really, it did not interest me except for radio. And I excelled in the radio electronics courses. But when it came time to go to college, I didn't have really great grades to get in, but I ended up going to Cal State Northridge anyway. And the way I got in was fascinating. Because my grades didn't qualify me to go in the front door, as it were, I went around the side door and said, listen, I think I really do qualify to be here, and I can demonstrate that I can do this level of work. And I was actually interviewed by an admissions officer who looked at my very short list of credits. He said, well, ham radio? I said, ham radio. And he said, that's one of those, that's a federal thing, right? Yes, I had to take federal tests. And by this time, I'd already tested to be a general. He said, well, you know what? I'm going to let you into Cal State Northridge because I feel like anyone who could pass these federal tests will do fine at Cal State Northridge. So it's because of my ham radio license that I got into Cal State Northridge.
That's amazing. We should say, by the way, the hometown was what? Los Angeles, right?
Correct. Born and raised in Los Angeles.
West L.A., because I think you mentioned to me Cheviot Hills.
Well, actually, I grew up in West Side. I went to Clover Avenue Elementary School, then Palms Junior, and then Hamilton High School. So I was kind of a little bit west of Cheviot Hills.
Okay, so I know the area. I actually spent some time there as a kid myself, and even as a young adult. Okay, well, that's very cool. So you got into Cal State Northridge, and what did you major in there?
I majored in hating it. Just did not like being there. I spent about a year and a half there. And as has been the case many times in my life, I took the road less traveled. And I left Cal State Northridge and went from a four-year university to a two-year college. I went to LA Trade Tech because LA Trade Tech had a splendid, just a renowned radio telecommunications program. So I left Northridge, enrolled in LA Trade Tech. Went through, it was on Dean's list every semester. In my last semester, Motorola, which was a sponsor of the radio communications program at that point, traditionally picked the top two students in that program and pulled them into Motorola. And I was one of the top two. So I was actually hired by Motorola out of LA Trade Tech even before I graduated. And that began my first career position. I was hired by Area F program management and worked on fascinating projects, the first simulcast systems, big microwave systems, public safety communications. And it was just, it's the type of thing where I got to play with stuff that normally you, if you worked at a MSS, you'd spend 5 or 10 years before you got to play with that stuff.
Right. I think the people that I knew that played with that stuff early worked for the public safety, like in Orange County Communications or something like that, right? And those were rare positions in those days.
They were. And I helped build the first simulcast system, which was in Kern County, California. It had to cover about 8,800 square miles. And we had multiple sites. We had a very early solar-only site. Now, we're talking late 70s. Ring microwaves and phased audio. It was just an amazing network to really learn on. And I was responsible for the dispatch centers, keeping the dispatch centers running. They were using PDP 1135 computers to do computer-aided dispatch. We had the MODATs, which were the first level or the first generation digital radios for sending digital IDs. Every time you'd key down, it would send a digital ID, so it would pop up on the dispatcher's display who was calling and their status. Cool stuff.
The microcontrol head, as I recall, had MODAT status buttons on it.
That's correct.
Very interesting. Well, I remember at that time, it must have been the late 70s, when Orange County Communications bought their first 800 megahertz analog repeater. And the speculation was, well, how could that even work? It's microwave frequencies. It won't have any range. It's not going to work. Surprisingly, it worked quite well.
It worked quite well, and it was part of the evolution of frequency for bandwidth, and bandwidth was necessary for a whole lot of things. Not the least of which was, you know, there were so few users at the time up in that spectrum that you had a lot of room to move around and try out different things and modulations and bandwidths, and it was just really neat stuff. And because the systems were really sold before they were understood, when I worked at Motorola and we were doing the first simulcast system, we were literally inventing things on the fly and pulling together products from other pieces that Motorola had to make this thing work. So the system was sold, and then Motorola figured out how to actually make it work. So we were, oh gosh, doing incredible things. And I remember that the manager at the time, I'll always remember this, he had a roll of butcher paper on a reel, like you walk into a deli and they'd pull off the butcher paper, and he had that on the side of his desk. And he would literally pull off a piece of paper and start scribbling designs and rip off the paper, and then it would go off to the engineers to actually build. That's the kind of work that we were doing. It was not just plug this into this, plug this into that, turn this on. We were actually making things work, and it was really amazing. It was just an amazing time to be in radio.
Motorola's way ahead of like General Electric and E.F. Johnson and all of those other companies, right? I mean, I don't recall that there was any innovation that was coming out of those companies the way that Motorola was doing it in those days.
Well, Motorola was ahead of Motorola at the time because, again, they would sell things, and then it would be the area people who would actually make it all work. So that was a heck of a lot of fun because we really were given tremendous range. We really could reach through anywhere in the company to get what we needed to support our first client, because remember, this was the first system, this was the first simulcast, so it was a demonstration project to show the world that Motorola could make all of this work, and we did, and it was just an amazing time to pull pieces together and make it work.
Well, Kern County in California isn't the largest. I think Riverside County is the largest county. San Bernardino County? Kern County is not the largest, but it's a huge county. But it was also, as I recall, it's desert and mountains. So it was a very difficult place to cover.
Right. San Bernardino is the largest county. Kern County, I believe, is the second largest county. And yes, it has 8,000-foot mountains. It has desert. It really has all sorts of topography. It's the southern portion of the Central Valley. And the way the simulcast system was designed to operate is you could be anywhere in the county with a handheld and have full communications. And that meant you'd be listening to multiple repeaters, which meant that those multiple repeaters had to be synced within a cycle of each other. We used to go up to the mountaintops and adjust the high stability oscillators. There was one site called Bird Springs where we would drive out 3.5 hours, 4 hours to get to the site to do about 15 minutes work and then drive back to Bakersfield. But that system worked and it provided the coverage. It was just, it was exactly what the county sheriffs and the county fire department needed.
So explain just for a second how simulcast works for the audience that probably we're way beyond that now because we were so channel diverse with what we use. But explain a little bit about simulcast.
The simulcast back in those days was analog, and it meant that basically you would have multiple transmitters all keyed up at the same time.
On the same frequency.
On the same frequency. So what would happen is you would have to have all of those transmitters locked as to frequency and as to audio phase. See, there was a twofer here. You had to not only frequency lock them, but you had to phase lock them for the audio so that a receiver, a handheld receiver, might be listening to two or three different sites at the same time, but getting the same audio in the same phase at the same time with nary a beat because the frequencies were so well locked together. Each of the high stability oscillators actually had an oven built in to keep the crystal source or the frequency source at the same temperature, regardless of the ambient temperature. And it was essentially a way of providing wide area coverage without having to change from going to peak A to peak B to peak C as you travel through the county.
Right, and that technology ended up being used later for wide area paging. And it was even more complicated, I think, with paging because at a certain point they started being able to connect those paging transmitters with satellite links. So now you had a time distance from satellite links and the phase and the frequency locking.
Yeah, you're talking about the SkyTel network. That was one of the first networks out there.
Or PageNet, for example.
PageNet, SkyTel, they were basically, exactly, it was basically satellite uplink downlink to a primary location.
So you're working for Motorola and you're on this cutting edge of everything that's interesting about radio. What happened after that?
Well, one of the downsides of working for Motorola at that point was I was living with some friends in a big house in Malibu, and I'd get a call Friday night saying, on Monday, go to New Mexico. On Monday, go to Nevada. On Monday, go to Northern California, wherever the projects were that they needed help on. And as a young man in his 20s, it was like, oh, this is all nice, but I'm not sure I like all this travel. So I started looking around for a job, and I went to the two obvious employers in Malibu, the phone company being one, General Telephone. I took their admissions or their aptitude test, and I got great scores on that. At the same time, I also walked into the cable TV company in Malibu, Warner Cable, and I said, are you looking for a technician? And they said, we're looking for a chief tech. And I said, what's a chief tech do? And they said, runs the system. I said, well, I don't know anything about cable TV, but I have a strong two-way background. And then they asked the key question, do you have a license? And by this time, I had not only picked up my amateur radio licenses, but I, along the way working at, going through LA Trade Tech, I picked up my third class, then my second class radio telephone. And while I was working for Motorola in Bakersfield, I took the first class radio telephone exam. So when I walked into the cable office in Malibu and they said, do you have a license? And I said, yes, I was hired on the spot because they had a microwave link and nobody assigned the logbook. So by virtue of the ticket, I had a job. And this is a recurring story in my life and something I always tell people. Yet every piece of paper you can, every license you have distinguishes you from someone who won't make the effort to get the license. There have been licenses I've never gotten a license that I needed at that very moment, except for my driver's license. And there's never been a license that I didn't use because I had it. So I'm a strong advocate in getting licenses, and amateur radio is certainly the foundation license for me from which everything else grew. So I walked into the cable office. They hired me. I ended up running the system. I didn't know anything about cable TV topology, but I knew about cable TV technology because instead of shoving a signal into an antenna, I shoved a signal into a piece of cable. So from that standpoint, it was very straightforward. And I ended up being the system engineer in Malibu for a couple of years. And I went over from there to be, I worked for a contractor for a while, cable contractor building cable systems. And then I was hired to be the chief technician of the cable system in South Orange County because they had trouble.
Which system in South Orange County?
It was the old Storer system in South County. And that system was experiencing a tremendous amount of signal ingress. They were basically, their pay channels were in the mid-band, and they were unusable because there was so much ingress and so much leakage. And this I knew. I knew about this because I knew how to track down this stuff. And I went in and I identified the problem, which was that the connectors that they were using, the hardline connectors they were using, were, Eric, you may know this from the old...
Substandard.
Well, they were feed-through connectors.
Okay.
They weren't cord connectors, and that allowed for leakage. So I went to my manager and I said, what's our capital budget for buying new connectors? And he said, capital budget? I'm sorry, what does that term mean? I said, okay. What's our repair and maintenance budget? Well, we can order $500 worth of connectors at a time. I said, thank you. I called up my friendly salesman from a company I liked, and I said, I need you to cut me orders for $499 each, and we're going to scam the system at Sewer Cable, and we did. And I brought the service level service calls down from about 9% a month to under 3%. And I really had a heck of a lot of fun. But because I understood transmission technology from all this previous experience, it was straightforward. And leakage was something that I knew. In fact, I'll tell you an interesting story going back a little bit. When I was in Malibu, the head end site in Malibu was on a place called Saddle Peak.
Sure.
Saddle Peak also has, or had at least at that point, one of the primary LAX FAA sites.
There was also a Nike missile site up there, too.
Pretty close.
Pretty close. Not on the same hill, but right close.
Right. In fact, that Nike site you're talking about is commonly used for field day now, but that's a separate story. Anyway, so I got a call from the FAA saying, we're getting bombed out at Saddle Peak. Is it your head-end equipment? I said, no, I'm sure it's not. And I went up there with a spectrum analyzer, and I identified that the actual interference was coming from a ham repeater on the same peak. So I called the owner of the repeater. I said, you have a problem, and I'm telling you this before you're going to get a call or a visit from the FAA and the FCC. That repeater went off in the air. I got a nice thank you letter from the FAA, which I still have to this day.
Did that repeater go back on the air?
Once they put a filter on the output, they did.
Let me ask a question. Did your Malibu cable television, did it have local origination? Did you have a studio in your Malibu office there? Because I remember in those days, like teleprompter cable in Newport Beach had even a live news show every afternoon from their tiny office in Newport Beach.
We didn't have the local origination. What we did was there was one guy who had a local FM station who fed it in, basically an FM modulator who fed it into the system. So we didn't have video. We only had FM origination at the time. But this is the late 70s, 1980. It was really before all the local origination was the rage in small systems. This was before the cable wars era. This was kind of the beginning of the cable wars.
Yes. I was involved as a studio guy in Cablevision in Newport Beach, teleprompter cable in Newport Beach. So I ran the cameras, or I ran the production switcher if they needed volunteers. We were never paid for any of this stuff, but it was a chance to kind of get your hands on television production.
So I'll tell you a fun story that ties back to Storer Cable, which was, I was hired as the engineer at the South Orange County system. Because of what I did in that system, I was promoted to be the regional engineer, and based out of Anaheim, I was responsible for all the cable TV technical operations from basically South Orange County out to the desert up to Kern County. And as the regional technical manager, we did have a major origination studio at the Anaheim office where I worked out of, and the manager of that system just hated origination. So he looked at me and he said, that's yours. So here I am, the technical, the regional engineer, and I'm responsible for local origination for that cable TV system. So it's amazing how if you limit yourself to the job you're doing, you'll never have the the jobs and the exposure to the other things. And again, I think I've been very lucky to be at the right place at the wrong time, or the wrong place at the right time, depending on your point of view. But it sure has been a heck of a lot of fun.
And now, this break. The QSO Today project that includes this podcast and the QSO Today Academy is now listener-sponsored. There are no commercial sponsors who influence the content and opinions expressed on QSO Today, including my blog posts. Disclaimer, we did not have a problem with sponsor influence when we did have commercial sponsors. The world is different now. I believe that commercial sponsorship, where you watch and listen to TV, radio, YouTube, Facebook, and X for free, does give sponsors complete control over all that you see and hear. The largest networks are now dominated by international corporations who decide in their boardrooms what we hear, know about, how we vote, and what we buy. Commercial sponsorship models for podcasts don't work, maybe for good reasons. At QSO Today, we are back to blogging and podcasting for the free expression of ideas, discussion, and the dissemination of content without commercial sponsorship. It takes everyone's ideas and approaches in our discussions to formulate our own way with the best information available. This has always been the best formula for success, even in ham radio. So QSO Today is now value for value, following the model created by another ham, Adam Curry, K5AAC, inventor of podcasting and the value for value business model. I create valuable amateur radio content that you consume. In return, you find it valuable, then you reward the podcast with your sponsorships, donations, transcription sponsorships, and using the QSO Today Amazon link. Your supporting the podcast in this way keeps QSO Today podcast coming to you every week since July of 2014, now approaching 500 episodes. In addition, we have over 500 educational ham radio videos from previous QSO Today virtual ham expos that we also publish to allow every ham to benefit from these excellent presentations. However, all of this content has to be produced, edited, curated, and hosted on commercial platforms by me and my team to keep it easily accessible and available to you. Links and banners on the show notes pages allow you to show your support of the QSO Today project. Please support QSO Today with your sponsorships, donations, and using our Amazon links. And now back to our QSO Today. It was a great time because obviously we didn't have the internet, we didn't have YouTube. To create original video productions, this was kind of a time of community access channel and your neighbors deciding that they wanted to do a show on cooking or fashion or something like that. It was a lot of fun. I think it was required. Wasn't it part of a city franchises often required, at least in some of the systems I ran in the Midwest, you know, in the 90s? We had to create original programming in the community as part of our license to work in the city.
In fact, in South Orange County, that was a requirement. And in one of the subsystems in South Orange County, they had a requirement to have a message board system, and they didn't have the equipment. They didn't have anything. So I bought a VIC-20 and programmed it in BASIC and then shoved the video output into a modulator and created a bulletin board channel, because that's what you did. That's what you did, an old VIC-20. Oh, gosh.
So what happened after that? And what were you doing with amateur radio this whole time?
Perfect transition. So when I was the regional manager for the cable system in Orange County, I also became the president of the South Orange County Amateur Radio Association, SORA, and I got corporate sponsorship to go to the ARL National Conference, which that year was in Houston, Texas, because cable TV and amateurs were starting to butt heads about leakage. And since I was the guy who knew about leakage, I was sent off to represent Storer Cable at the ARRL. And of course, I was already a life member. So I was doing a lot in that respect. I got Storer Cable to sponsor a number of the activities of SORA. And that's one of the things as amateurs, we have the opportunity to do, which is to reach through to our employers and get that sponsorship for amateur radio activities. And I did, and I was very successful, and I was very happy to do it. So that was about that time.
Jonathan, do you think that the association, or maybe the overlap of amateur radio operators working with cable television companies, actually made cable television companies, from an engineering standpoint, better, less leakage, and amateur radio operators maybe even better in terms of keeping their own equipment clean and functional. The relationship was actually ended up being good and improving both sides.
There are a tremendous number of licensed amateur radio operators in cable TV back then and now, and people who have become really important in terms of the cable TV industry. These are people who started as technicians in various systems and then went up into corporate. So amateur radio has embedded in the cable TV companies and is represented in the National Society, with the Society of Cable Telecommunications Engineers, which I've been a member for 40 years. They're just ham radio operators are throughout the cable industry because, for the same reason I was, which is this wasn't new to us. We understood transmission. We understood signals. We understood modulation. It was fun. So that's why you see a lot of amateur radio operators who have gone through cable TV systems all the way up to absolutely senior corporate management in cable systems. Amateur radio operators are everywhere in the cable TV business, even today.
Right. I believe that. I was in the finance side, so when I finally got to cable, but what a wonderful industry it was. I don't know whether it still is. I mean, it's probably reviled in a lot of places now because the business models may not work like they used to work, where they were exclusive franchises in areas.
You know, unfortunately, there are a lot of appliance operators now, technicians who go out and they're told, you know, if the meter says this, do this, as opposed to understanding the reasons why we do these things. So, again, that's one of the reasons why you see a lot of the cable TV licensees who are in senior positions in terms of technical management, because they're the ones who will do the mentoring, who will say, yeah, you have to understand intermod is this, it's two signals, it's mixing together, it's plus or it's minuses, and it creates this type of distortion. That's why you see it in the picture. You know, this is the stuff that, as a technician, I deal with a lot of technicians. In fact, the next phase of my career after I left Storer Cable, because of a merger, was I became an inspector of cable TV systems for local governments from 1984 through about 2006. I inspected hundreds of thousands of miles of plant. So I got to meet a lot of technicians. And the technicians who had a technical bent understood what they were doing. And the technicians who were trained on, now turn the meter on, flip it to this position. If the meter goes this far over to the right, then go look at this. And those are the people who I call them appliance operators, because they understand what to look for, but not why to look for. And you know, those appliance operators specifically exclude ham radio operators, because we're too damn inquisitive to just take the look at the meter as the answer.
Well, I think that was one of the things that impressed me the most about the hams in Southern California, especially the ones that were involved in repeaters and remote base stations and stuff like this, is that they were also mountaintop two-way guys. They knew how to carry the spectrum analyzer with them, and they knew what intermod products looked like, and they could tell you the math and how it works. And there was just this love for solving the problem. And I saw that in my own systems, you know, cable systems with technicians, that they just had this absolute fascination and love for the idea of squirting RF into a cable and seeing what comes out, especially when we started going digital. And I think you see that everywhere. So what caused you to make the transition? I mean, I'm looking now at your office with certificates on the wall and your Hawaiian shirt. So obviously you've moved way beyond.
I have to interrupt you. I'm sorry. I have a sister who passed recently, but she lived in Hawaii, and these are not Hawaiian shirts. These are aloha shirts. So please do not offend Hawaiians by calling these Hawaiian shirts. These are aloha shirts.
So you're wearing aloha shirts and you have a bunch of certificates on the wall, which means you've kind of made a transition from engineer technician to something else. So what was that transition and how did you make that?
Well, I'm going to take a stop along the way before I get there, because I think there's something important to talk about, which is that because of my technical background, I was selected to represent some of the national organizations, the National League of Cities, National Association of Telecommunications Officers and Advisors, U.S. Conference of Mayors, back in the late 80s, when in fact the FCC said, look, the technical specifications for cable TV are inadequate. Now, we can impose them, or you governments and you industry can work together and come up with some recommendations. And I co-chaired the government side committee that worked with the cable industry to come up with national technical standards, which in fact are still on the FCC's books today. And because of that, I was doing a lot of national work and it became very political, because when you negotiate technical standards, it's politics as much as it is engineering. Anybody who doesn't believe that doesn't know how these things work. And we were able to negotiate, and the FCC did adopt our recommendations, and that really opened some important doors for me. And by this time, I was a reasonably well-respected inspector on behalf of governments, but I went on to doing more expert witness work. And one of the cases that I was involved with was a small little case called Playboy versus the United States, which came out of the 1996 Telecom Act. And Section 505 of the Telecom Act had a requirement for cable TV systems to scramble adult channels. Playboy and another company sued the federal government, saying that it was technically impossible and also a violation of their First Amendment rights. I was hired by the FCC and the DOJ to be their technical advisor, their expert witness in that case. And I proved that in fact, what the law required was technically feasible. That part of the case was won. And I testified in federal court in front of a three-court federal panel in Wilmington, Delaware. That case went up to the Supreme Court several times. And eventually it was decided for Playboy, but not on technical grounds. Not on technical grounds. So I was very happy with the outcome of that, because we showed that the technology exists to do it. And it then became a purely First Amendment case. And for the lawyers out there, you know that when you're dealing with First Amendment, virtually every time the government loses, as it did in this case. So when I came back from testifying in that case, my wife, very soon after I got back, said, and this is almost a completely true story. I'll frame it that way. She said, you know, you're an idiot. I said, today? And she said, no, generally. But I said, okay, so why am I an idiot? She said, because you're already teaching continuing legal education courses on cable TV law. You're ghosting briefs for the federal government. You're doing legal research. You're teaching federal attorneys about this stuff. Why aren't you an attorney? And I basically made a gasping sound. And she said, and by the way, I've signed you up to go to a introductory meeting at a local law school here in Los Angeles. And I said, yes, dear. And I went and I had a ball. It was a legal education mid-career is an incredible experience, because the things that have made sense instinctively make sense because you understand how they come about. So it connected all the dots for me. And after I graduated, and as we like to say, eventually I passed the California bar, I, by that point, had a consulting company where I was, gosh, I had 700, 800 clients already by that point, local governments around the country who had hired me as a technical advisor. So I opened up a law firm with 700 or 800 clients on the first day. And they come back and they say, need some more help. And I said, okay, but it's going to be through the law firm. They said, well, we don't care. And that law firm now has grown to having six attorneys and four support staff and two CEOs, canine executive officers, I will tell you. Technically three. I've got to be careful. We have a third CEO.
You said canine executive officer?
Yes, we have three dogs who are members of the company.
I see. Oh, that makes sense.
They work for Kibble. By the way, canine efficiency officers are...
They're in the Kibble industry, right? Not the cable industry.
They're in the Kibble industry. They actually retard efficiency, but that's okay with us.
You know, I just want to interrupt here. The reason I was smiling when you're talking about this Playboy case is that I had systems in Tennessee, and there was a way to scramble the Playboy channel. We would introduce like an audio modulated signal into the carrier in order to kind of make it really wavy. Then there was filters that were used to get rid of it.
Positive traps.
Right, positive traps. So I get a call one afternoon, and it's the manager of the cable system in Tennessee, and he says, I'm in Denver. He says, I need your help. I said, what kind of help can I give you? He says, I need to be bailed out of jail. And I said, well, what happened? He says, well, apparently one of our traps failed at the local elementary school and the police came and arrested me. I said, well, so what was the channel? He says, it was a Playboy channel in the elementary school. I said, well, okay, we'll take care of it. But so we bailed him out. It was a technical breakdown of the positive trap that caused him to put his content, his extra paid content, into the elementary school. Yeah, that was a funny time to be in cable when all of that was happening. We were trying to figure out how to offer a pay service that people wanted, and at the same time to not put it in the places where it was not wanted.
Exactly. And in fact, it was positive traps that I showed to the federal court that said, this is how you can do it, and you can scramble the audio or have the, remember, it was a beep, 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 beep.
But it also messed up the video carrier too, right? It was because...
messed up the video carrier, but you'd still have teenage boys trying to kind of turning sideways.
Of course.
Of course.
Now, as kids, we had, if you remember, was it HBO was the first scrambled product in Los Angeles on Channel 52? Remember? If you go back into the 70s.
That was on TV.
On TV. Right, right, right.
Yes.
So all of us teenagers were trying to build scramblers that were to undo that just to see if we could.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you start this law firm. You have all of these clients. What are you doing in amateur radio at this time? It seems to me a busy guy like you wouldn't have any time for operating amateur radio. Yet if I look at your resume, it's full of things that you were doing at the same time. What were you doing?
I was an early adopter of Tapper. I built my first Tapper board. The serial number was in the low 300s. I've always been into digital communications. In fact, digital has always been one of my great pleasures in terms of amateur radio. So Tapper, but I really is went kind of low key for a while I was doing HF. In fact, my first HF rig when I was a novice was a 6L6 homebrew. But I then graduated up to my first real radio, which was a Yaesu FTDX 560, which, by the way, I still own to this day. I think over the years I've evolved to VHF and UHF. And really my greatest pleasure these days is in emergency communications as well as Arden radios, which are almost go hand in hand these days. But I've been very involved in amateur radio in terms of Aries. I am in the management of two Aries organizations, one, the larger one in Southern California, where I've been involved in terms of being the West Side representative and be responsible for one of the hospitals on the West Side, providing connectivity. I am a local government liaison for the Culver City Amateur Radio Association, Amateur Radio Service, technically, CCARES, where I represent the board of directors in front of the local government. And that's, by the way, that's really an important thing that as amateurs, we don't do very well. We don't represent ourselves in front of local governments very well. So I actually created this position and sold the board of CCARES that we needed to have FaceTime in front of the city council and tell them what we're doing. Because they were, the city of Culver City actually tremendously supports amateur radio and supports the Aries organization CCARES in the city. So we do that. And I guess that becomes a natural for me because of my work in terms of politics as an amateur radio operator. But because I work for cities, I've also been involved in dealing with amateur radio disputes with local governments. Permit issues. That's a very common one, is permit issues. I write ordinances on behalf of local governments that also touch on amateur radio. And not surprisingly, I pretty much take a hands-off amateur radio minimum. You know, the FCC back so many years ago passed adopted PRB1, which created a framework of national respect for amateur radio, if not preemption. California has a very strong, in fact, even stronger than PRB1 rule for amateur radio protection. So I've been called in by cities saying, we've got this application from an amateur radio operator and we don't understand it. I said, I do, and walk through it. And this is where the technical background comes into play again, because the amateur says, I need a 65-foot tower. Why? Because that's what's sold. Well, can you operate at a lower height? Well, I can, but it's not going to work as well. Okay. Do you have the IMAC documents to show the best takeoff angle versus height? Oh yeah, it shows 47 feet. Okay, can you agree to operate your tower at 47 feet? Because that'll give you your lowest angle of radiation. Oh, that makes sense. And this is how I've been able to solve problems with amateurs and local governments. Still the biggest issue.
Can I ask you a question, though?
Sure.
I think that most people these days, I see, for example, we're in an election season and everybody's concentrating on the presidential election. But it seems to me that most people, and most hams, but most people, they couldn't tell you who their city council members are. They don't know who's on the school board. They don't know anything about their local government. And those people have the most influence on their day-to-day life.
Right.
For amateur radio operators, I mean, I think there's a whole reason that people should know who they're. Today, as a matter of fact, in my town, we have a runoff election between two candidates for mayor who happened to be very close in the last election a week or two ago. So today, I'm going to go vote after this just for one of those candidates in this runoff election. Because, at least in my town, under the circumstances that we live in, the city council is essentially important to our lives, our very lives at this point. But I don't think most people know this, you know, about their own. So if you're an amateur radio operator, why should I become involved in my local government as an amateur radio operator? And how do I get the training or understanding of what are the issues for the city government? What do they have with me? And how do we work together?
The why is very easy. It's to overcome ignorance. And most elected officials are ignorant of amateur radio. In a worst-case scenario, they think it's the same as cell towers. And that's just wrong. It's one of the reasons why I created this position at SeaCares to be a local government liaison, so that we have a way of talking to the electeds and doing that education, because they are the ones who adopt the ordinances that regulate antennas, placement, setbacks, permit fees. That's always a big issue. Permit fee, the cost of getting a construction permit. And permit fees can be really substantial. Both PRB1 and, in fact, in California, the California legislation talks about the minimum regulation required for amateur radio. So amateur radio operators need to be politically aware of local governments because they set the rules. And having a good relationship with amateur radio operators from the city side and amateurs with the city is important. But, you know, this all comes back down to when the S hits the fan and we're the only ones that are working. So being out there and being involved in CERT, Community Emergency Response Team, with ARES, I'll pick on Culver City because they're doing things so well there. We just had field day, winter field day a few weeks ago, and it was at a fire station. We actually set up at a fire station, and then the fire department gave us one of their emergency trailers to use during field day. So in Culver City, they've got a spectacular relationship with the fire department, who is the sponsor. In fact, our EOC is within their main fire department headquarters. We have a great relationship with the city council. But these are the things that amateur radio operators don't do effectively.
Was that a media opportunity, that your winter field day, for a more knowledge of amateur radio by the general public?
We actually, during the summer field day, operate from a state park, which is a very popular park. The field day during the winter, no, because it's behind lock gates. It's inside fire department headquarters. But we wanted to test it. We had never operated from that particular fire station before, so we wanted to see how well it would work from there. It turned out it didn't work very well. But now we have more information, and it just helps us to cement why our main operations are at the main fire station. The bottom line is amateurs are known for experimentation, and we need to do as much experimentation within our emergency communications. That's why we do field day. It's why we do winter field day. It's why we do summer field day. It's why we do all of those other things that are contests, but in fact help us really hone our skills operating.
Do we forget that, though? I mean, do we forget that that's really the purpose of these field day operations, is to hone these skills?
I hope that we don't forget them. If you get the training and it's flavored like candy, well, you're still getting the training, okay?
Can I go back a little bit in terms of local governments? The big problem that a lot of people tell me is they can't buy a house that's not in an HOA. But an HOA tends to be in a local government. The streets may be owned by the city and county where they live. What's the impact of involvement in local government when you have an HOA that you have to deal with in terms of being able to put up antennas and to be able to support your amateur radio hobby there?
So let's define some terms here. An HOA is a homeowners association, and essentially it's a group of homeowners who are owners of homes in the same community. And when the community was developed by a developer, the developer created an HOA, a homeowners association, which is basically a local government. So they operate at the very bottom, closest to the ground level. And those HOAs will often have rules that say you can't have external antennas. Now, this is different from local governments. Local governments create rules for entire cities. HOAs create rules for small neighborhoods. And things that local governments cannot do because of law, HOAs can. And this is a huge tension. In fact, there's currently a new bill that has been introduced at the federal level that would preempt a lot of these local HOA regulations and allow for antennas where they are prohibited by the local rules of the HOA. These are good things because at the end of the day, we can't operate as amateur radio operators without antennas. It turns out that's pretty amazing, but true. You need antennas to work. And antennas need to be generally above what we call the clutter, the top of the building, the trees. You can't have them at ground level for the most part. So HOAs are very problematic for amateur radio operators. And in fact, I give a lecture to local clubs here in California. In fact, I've done as far as a couple of states away, but on dealing with local governments and HOAs. And you can't deal that much with HOAs because their rules so far are enforceable against amateurs.
And they're enforceable because when you move into the HOA, you actually sign a contract.
You sign a contract that says, I agree to be subject to these rules. And the crazy thing about it, the craziest thing about it, from my perspective, in fact, I cover this in one of my lectures. The lecture, of course, is I'm from the government and I'm here. But the crazy thing about HOA rules is that, let's say you've got a ham radio operator at one end of an HOA and then a quarter mile away. There's another part of the same HOA. Well, that person who can't see the antenna, has nothing to do with it, doesn't even know that, otherwise wouldn't know that it's there, can still object by saying, look, I had to sign these rules. The amateur had to sign these rules. I can enforce the rules against the amateur called an equitable servitude. Essentially, anybody who's subject to the rules can enforce those same rules against anybody else who's subject to those rules. And this is a major issue for amateur radio. And so much of this predates really a good understanding of amateur radio. During the building boom of the 70s, the 80s, a lot of these HOAs were created, and someone had a boilerplate that said no external antennas. Now, the thinking was no external TV antennas, which interestingly has been overruled by the FCC now under the OTARD rules, the over-the-air receiving devices rules, but the FCC has never extended those OTARD protections to amateur radio. So those rules that were originally created in CCNRs to prohibit TV antennas have effectively been used to prohibit amateur radio antennas. It's not a good situation.
And now this mid-show break. Every 2 weeks, I listen to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast with George, KJ6VU, Vince, VE6LK, Mark, N6MTS, Thomas, K4SWL, Michael, VA3MW, and Rod, VA3ON, and their guest on often topical and important projects in amateur radio. This discussion amongst the regulars and their guests remind me of the conversations that I used to listen to on 146.94 and 146.46 megahertz in Orange County, California, while working on my own workbench almost 50 years ago. It is amazing how much practical ham radio knowledge that we can absorb by listening to the Workbench podcast that starts to make sense when we start our own deep dive into our own projects. So join me by listening to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast now and as George and crew push beyond 200 episodes. You can get to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast by clicking on the banner in this week's show notes page. And now, back to our QSO. Are you optimistic that with the federal legislation that perhaps that will actually go through? And are you optimistic from that standpoint?
Well, we are recording this talk between two friends at a time when the federal government is completely dysfunctional. And do I expect something as innocuous as amateur radio protection to get through Congress? I actually have a higher hope because it is innocuous. Maybe it can sneak through. But then again, you just never know. That legislation's been kicking around in various forms over years. The ARL has been a strong supporter of getting waivers, of trying to get OTAR protections, trying to get Congress to step in. Getting back after I'm going to circle back for a reason here. After I left Northridge and went to Trade Tech, years and years and years later, I as you know and figured out, I went and got a JD. After that, I didn't stop. I went and got a Master's of Law degree in telecommunications law. And then I finished my terminal degree as a doctorate in law and policy from Northeastern University. Well, if there's anything I've learned in terms of policy and learned it from Northeastern is that policy is constantly evolving. It's really policy is a circle. You begin and you get on and you look for policy entrepreneurs, people who share the same policy interests, even though there's an old saying in policy, which is there are no permanent enemies, only permanent issues. So you find the people you can support. So do I think that this will eventually change? Yes. How long it will take? It will take the right policy windows to open for this to sneak through. I wish my crystal ball were so well polished that I could tell you when, but I think it will happen. I just don't know if it's going to be in 2 years or in 10 years. But I think the value of amateur radio, the policy windows will open, unfortunately, after a major disaster, after amateur radio operators step up, and when the cell phones crap out, and when the broadcasters go off air, and when a lot of the emergency communications and even the PERSNET operations go down, and amateur radio stays up, that's when our policy windows will open to help Congress justify the preemptions that we're talking about right now. So it's waiting. I hate to put it this way, but we're waiting for the right disaster.
Yeah, well, on this side of the world, we're almost there. I just bought a 7,000-watt generator. I'm getting batteries for my ham station to trickle charge so I have enough to make communications. I'm experimenting with Meshtastic so that the neighbors have messaging between their cell phones. It does put things in a very specific light. And it's interesting to me that even after Hurricane Katrina and after Hurricane Sandy and all the stuff that the right people don't see the value of amateur radio when nothing else worked. The hurricane in Puerto Rico was an amazing example of how everything can disappear for weeks, weeks and weeks, and amateur radio is the only way to communicate.
Right. We didn't disappear. We're the ones who didn't disappear.
Right. People got on airplanes and flew into the disaster area with their amateur radios and provided the communications. I'm very curious. You mentioned a little bit earlier about, you know, appliance technicians, appliance engineers. Do you think that, because I've talked to a number of people who are in the broadcast industry, who are involved in the Society of Cable Television Engineers, who are thinking that, you know, because it doesn't seem that young people have hobbies, at least other than smartphone viewing, like we did when we were kids and stuff, is there a supply of upcoming young people to be engineers of the caliber that maybe our generation, the generation before that, put out to be able to create this innovation in all these industries?
The answer is absolutely not, and yes. And I'll tell you what I mean. The world is not a static place, as we all know. And we know that right now, and what we see on the horizon is artificial intelligence, and that how people maintain things will be based on inputs from AI. Will there be a place for amateur radio operators? Because amateur radio really belies a connection to AI. We'll still have people who are intelligently aware of the technology as opposed to simply going down a checklist, going, okay, if A, then B, if C, then D. going through those decision trees. The biggest thing we need to do is to identify how to bring in young people into our hobby. And this is like so many of us started at the high school level. This is the electronic classes in high school. We need to focus on that.
Are they still there? I went to the same school system that you were in as a kid. I was just talking to somebody yesterday because the generator I'm getting only has 3 hours worth of gas tank. But we have natural gas, or essentially butane, that comes out of a large tank on the street. And so I'm converting my brand new generator to natural gas. And it's not so hard, but I understand how it works. And this guy asked me, he says, well, how do you understand how that works? I said, well, I went to public school in California, and we had auto shop, electronic shop, wood shop. I took all of those classes in addition to the college prep classes. And so I had exposure to all of that. I spent years holding the light. And I think amateur radio, because, you know, you've got to pull a generator in for field day or you've got to do something, it gives you this expertise that you couldn't get anywhere else. But I don't think that public schools anymore, at least you can say this in California, but I think across America, no longer think that those classes were important. And so they eliminated those classes from the curriculum.
There will still always be people who are naturally inquisitive. You know, I don't know if you know this name, but Zyla Foxland, have you heard of her?
No, but I'm writing it down.
You need to write it down. This is someone who you absolutely must meet. She is a young doer and experimenter and has involved amateur radio, very popular on YouTube, and is really whetting the appetite of young people towards do-it-yourself stuff. And between various technologies, these are the people that we need to get to be the influencers who said it's cool to be in STEM. STEM is so important, and supporting STEM.
But STEM is a kind of a college. I mean, what if you're ADD, ADHD, but you're good with your hands and stuff like this?
STEM is not a college thing. I absolutely disagree with you. We need to be involving people into STEM courses and philosophy and direction at the high school level, even if not sooner than that. We need to get them excited. We need to let them know that there are STEM opportunities, and especially for young women who are still underrepresented, both in STEM and in amateur radio.
Okay, well, STEM is what? Science, technology, engineering, and math, right? I have a sense from talking to you, Jonathan, that as a C student in high school, that maybe mathematics was not your strongest suit. And frankly, I died in engineering school on the altar of differential equation and ended up getting a history degree. So I'm saying that on the one hand, on the other hand, I can fix anything, whether it's mechanical or electronic. And there are a lot of people like that. And that's, so when you say STEM in school, I kind of think that it's in the classroom and stuff like that, and it's not in the electronic shop. But maybe you've got it. Maybe there's something else happening that I'm not aware of. Or maybe we should be, because we're involved in our local city councils and school boards and stuff, maybe we should be involved as amateurs in pushing the hands-on side of the technology. What do you think about it?
We absolutely should. And in fact, yes, I was a very, very average student in math because it really wasn't interesting to me. It wasn't relevant to me until I got into high school. And in electronics, suddenly imaginary numbers made sense because I was doing calculations for impedance and reactance. And this is what interested me. So I immediately knew the math because it made sense. It was relevant to me. It had to be made relevant. And when it was, I was an A student. I was an A student through the rest of my education, absolutely through the rest of my education, because the things that were relevant to me opened doors for me into my mind. And this is why finding out what triggers young people to be interested in something, we'll find the people who are interested in amateur radio because they just don't know it yet. We have to find them and show them amateur radio. And we will find a lot of people who would just say, yeah, that's not very interesting to me. And then we'll find the, oh, wow, this is really cool, kids. So this is, it's like anything else. It's a numbers game. And until we're out there and we're introducing amateur radio at the junior high school and the high school level and taking down some of the barriers, and right now that the FCC license fees, well, the ARL has stepped forward to reduce some of those fees, Our club, Sea Cares, has there's a fund to support initial licenses so that those licenses are basically you pass the test, you don't pay. Things like that.
How do we get a parent to deliver their child to an amateur radio club meeting when they don't want to sit in the back of the room at all with their kid?
You know, there's no single answer to this, but what there is what is important is you have to have the local government support. You know, if we're just a ham radio club operating a loose association, that's one thing. But when the city council, when the county government supports it, and you know, we're having our meeting at the fire department. In one of the two organizations I belong to, we meet at a major hospital in the San Fernando Valley. They make their facility available to us at no charge because we support them. That's at Valley Presbyterian Hospital. In Culver City, our meetings are held at the municipal, there's a municipal building, and we have access to that because the city supports us. So it's the third-party credibility that makes us different and overcomes some, but not all, of the concerns that you have. But again, this is a numbers game. We're not going to get 50% of the people we're trying to say, hey, come look at this. If we can get 5%, it's a numbers game. You build on small numbers, and you build the next level up and the next level up. And once you have older brothers and older sisters who are involved, younger brothers and younger sisters will have at least exposure to it and will want to know.
Well, I always hope with my students that they're so infatuated by the hobby or by whatever it is they've learned that they are thought leaders for their age. So when they become teenagers, because they're doing something that's completely different than all their friends, that they kind of act as this magnet for bringing other kids into the hobby. But I think we're challenged now. It's not just amateur radio. I mean, I think that like every hobby is challenged with people not participating in hobbies. We're at a point now where it seems that everything's disposable and nobody needs any skills for anything. And I guess I'm worried that I'm the only guy in a city of 15,000 people that knows how to convert a gas generator to natural gas, because I know how they work and I can find the instructions on YouTube. I owe my ability to do anything because of my amateur radio background. I'm frustrated and at a loss because I see that it's almost like Forbidden Planet. We're talking about AI and we're talking about this technology that we have that could overtake us, because we don't have an interest in how things work. We assume they just work.
There will always be inquisitive minds that are looking for things to be inquisitive about. I believe that. I want to believe that, and I want to take the steps to find those minds and give them an opportunity. And if people will take the opportunity, that's great. But at least we've got to offer them the opportunity. We don't do that very well. We just don't reach out very well to expose amateur radio to young people. And that's why this is a hobby with older people. But I'm 69 years old. I've been an amateur radio operator for 54 years now. And unfortunately, I'm probably closer to the top of the bell curve than not.
Yeah, you might be, actually. So what could we do different? I mean, I'm curious. You mentioned, for example, that you're doing Arden. And I think that for young people, it seems to me that Arden kind of meshes well with a lot of the Venn diagram. There's a lot of overlapping things here, you know, with Arden. You can use it with your Wi-Fi. You can use it with your cell phone. You can use it with, there's a lot of stuff there that could also make you a network engineer if you know how to actually do Arden right. What are you doing with Arden? And did that play a role in your winter field day? And does it attract, at least in your club, does it attract younger people to say this is like really fascinating?
We have an extremely extensive network in Southern California for Arden. We have super hubs. We have all sorts of backbones. And yet, where I live in Santa Monica, I'm the Lone Ranger. I'm one of only a couple stations in Santa Monica, and I'm an island connected to the Arden network through a internet tunnel.
You can't actually connect to an Arden site from where you're at.
Right. I don't see anything from where I am. Although I should, the problem is that we need a hilltop site. And in fact, some of us are working to make that happen. But it's an early development. And you're absolutely right. Arden meshes nicely with people who are interested in networking, computer networking, with PBXs, with messaging, all sorts of things. And it's the fact that it's a shadow network that touches, it's almost like the amateur radio dark net.
Right. Or the parallel universe to the internet.
It is. And again, if we find the right people who are interested in it, this is really cool. I don't mean to cover ground we've already covered, but again, it's a numbers game. We've got to get in front of more people so that we get that percentage that is interested in coming in. And it's a multiplier effect too. Again, it's once you have someone in the family, like right now, one of my two daughters just passed her FAA drone pilots, the remote pilots exam, which I passed a while back. So she's now a remote pilot. And now she wants to study for her technician license.
What does that mean? She has to have an FAA drone pilot's license. I mean, are you talking about if she goes to a toy store and buys a $300 drone, she actually has to have a license to fly that in California?
It's in the U.S. And it depends on if you're using the drone commercially. It depends on the size of the drone. The FAA licenses drone pilots, called remote pilots.
Really? Oh, that's amazing.
And the reason why I am is because in my business, when I'm doing wireless site inspections, it's easier to do it by drone than any other way. So it's a perfect extension of what I do as an amateur radio operator is to use drones for flying over radio sites.
As a cable operator, you could actually do leakage detection using drones now?
Leakage detection using drones would be a very, very good thing, especially if you're trying to get to back property where you can't do it. Or it's much more efficient to fly over a cable line to find that one loose connection or that one piece of cable that someone decided to say, that's a good thing to shoot at, and it creates a hole. So yeah, drones here are very important in terms of inspection work. So that's why we have in our law firm drone pilots, and that's why the next license my daughter wants to get is a technician license, because she's also
for amateur radio technician license.
Exactly, she's concerned about emergency communications.
Maybe she'll be an influencer.
I can only hope.
Well, it sounds to me your father's an influencer as well.
I've been very lucky to be the right person at the wrong place at the right time, depending on your point of view. But the fact that you and I are able to talk about this, the fact that you have an audience, the fact that I hope that I've shared, the fact that we need to do better as a hobby at the local level, interacting with our local government officials and our planning directors who are normally forgotten about, our city attorneys. These are, frankly, all these people influence our ability to operate either with support or with hassles in our local community. If we have the local government behind us, and again, I will look to Culver City as an example, Culver City, California, where there's a strong relationship, it's great. There are some communities in Southern California where the local governments are, frankly, just hostile to amateur radio, and they have in their codes restrictions on amateur radio that predate PRB1 or predate the California law, and yet they're still on the books, and the planning directors still enforce them because, hey, it's in the code, so I got to enforce it.
Or they haven't been updated.
That's the point. It's exactly the point.
Right, because there's a lot. I mean, when you think about it, if you're in city government and you're a bureaucrat in city government, there's so much stuff that's being run through the mill that unless it's brought to your attention, you may not know about it. May not know about the things that have changed just by the enormous amount of information. Can I ask you, what excites you the most about what's happening in amateur radio now? What really floats your boat?
Well, without a doubt, it's emergency preparedness. And that's really at my core. What I really enjoy the most in amateur radio is knowing that when the big earthquake hits, I'll be the one that the neighbors will come to. I'm the one who has the solar panels. I'm the one who has the solar charge controllers. I'm the one who has cert training. I'm the one who knows how to get out for communications purposes. I know where those resources are. I'm I don't hope for the earthquake, but I know it's coming.
Except you're on the wrong side of the San Andreas Fault.
No, I'm pretty sure my part of the San Andreas, my side of the San Andreas is not going to fall in the ocean, despite popular concerns to the contrary. No, but I've gone through major earthquakes. I'm born and raised in Southern California, so I've gone through the major earthquakes here, and understanding that and understanding what happens, I mean, I really feel sorrier for the people who live in Hurricane than Tornado Alley.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because they get hit year after year after year. We're once every 20 years. If anything, that is worse for us because we're more complacent and not prepared compared to the people who are in Tornado Alley or who are subject to hurricane. They're smart because they have the experience. So they know what to do and they know how to take it seriously. I don't think that we take it all that seriously here.
I think we forget in Southern California that a lot of the built-up infrastructure that you live in, for example, in Santa Monica, that infrastructure is now almost 100 years old.
Yeah, the newer parts of it, yes.
So, you know, Southern California is at least 60, 70 years old, the established neighborhoods. They may have been great for earthquakes then, maybe they're not, but I'm just saying that you become complacent. You don't think about foundations and you don't think about infrastructure and things like this, especially when they're old and they're not replaced regularly.
We still have infrastructure that's over 100 years old. We experience regular water main breaks, sewer breaks, problems with electricity because we have mature infrastructure that hasn't grown or been replaced to follow the population trends. So is our network fragile? Yes. Are most people prepared to be on their own for a few days? No. I have here in my office, I have a week's worth of dehydrated food. I have water here. Same thing at home. Well, people in Southern California don't know that in an emergency, if all you've got is $5 bills, everything costs $5. So you have to have $1 bills. These are the things you learn from experience.
By the way, having cash.
Cash is the only thing you have. It's the only thing you can have.
Right, because your credit card is not going to work in an emergency.
Without being very specific, I will tell you that I have cash stashes at the appropriate places. So wherever I am, I know that I have an emergency supply of cash because cash is king or queen.
Yeah, that's very important.
During the 94 earthquake, 93 earthquake here, I experienced a price gouging. It was actually in Northridge, and at that time I lived about 3 miles away from the epicenter and only about a mile above the hypocenter. And for those of you who don't know earthquake terms, you should look it up because those are very different terms. I've ridden out some really interesting rides, I'll put it to you that way.
Well, it sounds to me like you've had an amazing ride. Before we go, do you have advice that you'd give to new or returning hams to the hobby?
Well, I think obviously I'm a big proponent to be an amateur radio operator who is prepared to support the community in an emergency. However you do that, it's better than not doing it. But have fun. Find things that are interesting. Don't just have a license and a radio that you'd never turn on. I every year now I do the part of the team that supports the Los Angeles Marathon. In fact, yesterday I attended our pre-meeting for the LA Marathon, which is next weekend, and for years I've worked out on the track providing emergency communications for it. I love the marathon. It's a wonderful experience. I do the Rose Bowl Marathon as well. Find something in amateur radio that really whets your appetite and really dig into it. And you will find other people who share the same interests that you do. You meet a lot of nice people in amateur radio. And the fact that you have this in common just opens doors. In an emergency, if I was somewhere and I was really in trouble, I would look for the house with the tower. I would walk up to that door any day of the week and know that I would be welcome because I can talk amateur radio, and amateur radio operators look out for amateur radio operators.
And by the way, you can do that anywhere in the world.
I have no doubt about it. I would look for the antennas, and that's where I'm going to go for help. That's the first door I'm going to knock on is a house with ham antennas on it. No question about it. No question about it.
Jonathan, this has really been a lot of fun for me. I hope that you enjoyed being a guest on the QSO Today podcast. With that, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule. And I know it's the middle of the night now. We've been talking for a while. Thank you so much for coming on.
Eric, it's been an absolute pleasure and truly a privilege, because you've helped me to remember things, getting prepared for this, and even just talking today that I haven't thought about in years. And I think back so fondly on the things that I've accomplished, in large part because I started as an amateur radio operator. So thank you for that.
My pleasure. 73. That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Jonathan. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. I am now adding summaries and outlines of our discussion to make it easier to find specific points raised in our QSO. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put in W6JLK in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, push the Sponsor Transcription button in the center of every show notes page. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing the subscribe buttons on the show notes pages. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. If listener sponsorship is not for you, then please use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on everything you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast, and it costs you nothing. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform by using Podcast Index. Use the latest Podcast 2.0 player on your smartphone to automatically get to your podcast updates as soon as we publish. I'm now using Podverse to track, manage, and listen to my podcasts. Positive comments about QSO Today on social media is appreciated, as it helps to grow our listener base. My thanks to Ben Bresky, who makes this podcaster and guests sound brilliant. Thanks, Ben. Until next time, this is Eric, 4Z1UG, 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.